Good morning, everyone. I'm going to be talking about a class of methods that we've developed for solving free boundary problems. Let me get started. The objective of my talk is to introduce these methods. And the central idea, behind these methods is essentially to take a free boundary problem and convert it into a sequence of fixed boundary problems. And as we all know, fixed boundary problems are much easier to solve. So if we can convert it into a monotone sequence of fixed boundary problems, then we're probably going to do much better, and I'll show you how well we do. In terms of today's talk, I'm going to start with the simplest case of American option pricing problem. And we're going to use this problem just so I can show you how intuitively we construct such transformations. And then we're going to, well, the American option pricing problem is an optimal stopping problem. And then we're going to move on to the harder problem of portfolio optimization in multiple dimensions. And this is a singular control problem, but here we are going to essentially see how we can actually solve problems of certain much larger dimension. And if we have the time, that's why I put it in brackets, if we have the time, which I seriously doubt, I'd briefly talk about impulse control problems as well. One impulse control problem. And finally, before I conclude, I'll give you an overview of all the theoretical guarantees that we've been able to establish with these classes of methods. Okay, let's start with the American option pricing problem. We have the standard setting. We have an asset, ST, that follows a geometric Brownian motion. We have a risk-free rate, R, and a constant volatility, sigma. And we're looking at a put option with a strike price of Q and an expiry at tau. And T, which is our variable, will be time to expiry, so it's the inverse of time. So option price denoted by the price P when time to expiry is capital T, X, X being the underlying asset price, is nothing but the supremum over all possible exercise times of the expected payoff. Okay, we have the standard setting. What we have is a free boundary problem. What we are looking for in the two-dimensional space of X and time to expiry T is we're looking for a boundary CT, capital T is our time variable, CT such that above CT, if you find yourself above CT, it's optimal to hold, and you exercise the option when you hit the exercise boundary, optimal exercise boundary CT. And the related free boundary problem is obtained by standard dynamic programming arguments and the Itô's formula, and it says LFP, which is our second order PDE operator, LFP is equal to zero if the state is above the exercise boundary. The price is equal to the exercise value, Q minus X, the positive part, if it's below the optimal exercise boundary. And this is the Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation, which says that the maximum of LFP and the payoff minus the price is equal to zero. So essentially, each of these two terms are either negative or zero. Okay, so in this region, this term is zero. In the region above, the holding LFP is equal to zero. So what we are essentially looking for is a price function, P, and the optimal exercise boundary, C, such that all these three conditions hold. One thing I'd like to point out is you can choose any arbitrary boundary, any arbitrary exercise policy. Okay, you could just draw a curve in two-dimensional space and use that exercise policy. What would happen is you can always solve LFP is equal to zero above and set P is equal to Q minus X, the positive part below, and use this as a boundary condition to solve LFP equals zero. But what will happen is this Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation will not be satisfied for any arbitrary boundary. There's only one boundary for which you can have this satisfied, and that's the free boundary problem that we're looking for. That's the free boundary we're looking for. So let's start with a method. Okay, so I'm going to draw an arbitrary boundary, C naught. The only assumption here is that C naught is below the optimal exercise boundary, just an arbitrary boundary. Okay, and this is an exercise policy, not the optimal one, and I can definitely use this. If I hold an option, I could use any exercise policy. I don't have to use the optimal one. So we can look for what is the value associated with using this arbitrary policy. To get the value associated with this policy, I can solve LFP is equal to zero above this boundary, And below this boundary, I'm going to excise, obviously, so I'm going to set P naught is equal to the positive part of Q minus X. Okay, I can solve for this. And the guest C naught is below, the only assumption I'm making is the guest C naught is always below C star, which is optimal value. Sure, this Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation is going to be violated. If it's not violated, if it's satisfied entirely, by chance we just accidentally drew the optimal boundary, so which most probably is not the case, so this is going to be violated. It turns out, because C naught is uniformly below C star, the violation will be in an area just above your guest boundary. Okay, so let's say the violation of the HJB equation is in this region, and the violation will happen in this term. Okay, this term is going to be positive in some areas. And since it's positive, what it tells us is that the P naught, the value of using this specific policy is less than the payoff at that point. So obviously, it's better to do immediately exercise there, right? So if I move this boundary C naught to anywhere within the gray area, anywhere, if I draw any boundary in the gray area, that's guaranteed to do better than C naught, okay? So we started with the C naught that we assumed was uniformly below the optimal boundary. So from an iteration standpoint, it would be good to draw one more boundary, C1, in the gray area that also guarantees that it's below C star. Then I could simply keep iterating it over and over again. So it turns out if I choose the dotted line all the way up to the top, such guarantee will not be possible. We would obviously we overshoot C star. Okay, so we don't want to go all the way up. So it turns out, but instead of going all the way up, if I go to the point that along every vertical direction minimizes P plus X, P naught plus X. Okay, this is nothing more than saying, okay, I know that P naught is less than Q minus X plus, so I know that P naught is equal to Q minus X plus here, and at the dotted line also I know that P naught is equal to Q minus X plus because that's the last point where the violation will stop. So I just go to the point that maximizes the difference between the two, and that is this contour. Okay, so I take C naught, I solve for the associated value function, I look for all points where the HJB is violated, and I draw a contour of those points that indicate maximum violation in some sense. Okay, and it turns out, because C naught was guaranteed to be below C star, you can prove that C1 is also guaranteed to be below C star. Okay, so now we have a better boundary, but we still have the same guarantee that we had for our initial guess, so we can keep using this iteration over and over again to improve the policy. Okay, so let's start with an example. Let's show an example. Okay, this is my C naught, which I've set it at 5, and the strike price is at 100, risk-free rate 8%, and the volatility, underlying asset volatility is 20%. So with this C naught, I solve for my value function, and my first iteration, second, third, okay. So with around 6 iterations, 5 or 6 iterations, depending upon the tolerance value you use, you get convergence. Okay, so what we have essentially done is we've taken the free boundary problem, which is American option pricing problem with the unknown excised boundary, and converted it into a sequence of 6 boundary problems. And each of the 6 boundary problems do not have any nonlinear term. They're still the same linear equation that you, HJB, the same linear PD that you started with. And solving these 6 boundary problems, of course, in time, with respect to time, is going to be very efficient. So I'm going to show some runtime and error comparisons. Okay, at this point, what a caution. When you talk about American option pricing, there are 2 classes of methods. One that exploit the conditional expectations, and the other set of methods that actually solve the PDEs. The conditional expectations-based methods essentially give you the price, and the price of an American option for an underlying stock price at a given point in time. Of course, you can't compare those methods with the PDE-based methods because the PDE-based methods look for computing the entire price function. So in this comparison, I'm only going to compare it against some PDE methods that actually solve the entire PDE problem as well, the actual PDE problem as well as some of the integral methods. Okay, so this is a log-log plot of root mean square errors versus runtimes. All of these were done on MATLAB. So I have the moving boundary method, as we call it, And the moving boundary method, essentially all it does is takes a free boundary problem and converts it into a sequence of fixed boundary problems. It's your choice to solve the fixed boundary problem in any method you want. You could use a finite element, you could use a finite differences, and these are 2 points for the finite element method with 8,000 nodes and 500 nodes, and these are the moving boundary methods with finite difference methods, and these are integral methods, the Berlin-Schwarz method, the penalty method, and the front fixing method for one specific grid settings. The penalty method adds nonlinear term to the PDE, and because of the nonlinear term, with both front fixing and penalty methods, both become nonlinear PDEs. The computational times depend upon the nonlinear solver that is used, and we use the CPLEX nonlinear solver to get these, while all the others are implemented on MATLAB from scratch. Okay. So I'll move on to portfolio optimization with transaction costs. The thing with these methods is portfolio optimization is essentially a multidimensional problem. We always talk about a one-dimensional portfolio optimization with the hope of being able to get to multidimensions because a portfolio generally contains multiple stocks. With American option pricing, you can still talk about a multidimensional American option pricing, but the fundamental problem is actually a one-dimensional problem. Most options are on one dimension. Of course, there are options that are multiple dimensions too. But portfolio optimization is essentially multidimensional. So when we talk about portfolio optimizations with transaction costs, we can talk about proportional or fixed plus proportional transaction costs. And fixed plus proportional transaction costs give you impulse control problems, while proportional transaction costs give you singular control problems. So we're going to talk about, for now, only proportional transaction costs, which give you a singular control problem. So we have proportional transaction costs for buying stock I, which and the cost of buying one unit of stock I is 1 plus lambda I, and the cost of, and what you get from selling one unit of lambda I is 1 minus mu I, lambda I and mu I being the proportional transaction cost for selling, for buying and selling. And we're going to look at maximizing the long-term growth rate using the objective that was made considered in Tuxer, Klass, and Asaf. And the value of stocks in the bank account, if I is the list of stocks, is a geometric Brownian motion and adjusted for the controls that you use. This is the cumulative amount of, L is the cumulative amount of stocks bought and U is the cumulative amount of stocks sold. So these are differentials. And you have the transaction costs going out of your bank, and the way the bank account evolves is also shown. Okay, so with no transaction costs, it's the classical Merton problem. The optimal thing to do is to make infinite number of transactions, infinite transactions to always stick to one line. I haven't drawn that. It's the Merton line. So in three-dimensional space, when you're typically looking at two stocks, you're living in three-dimensional space. And when you don't have transaction costs, the optimal thing to do is always transact to stick to one specific point. When you have transaction costs, obviously, it becomes too expensive to stick to the Merton line. So what happens is that the optimal region of inaction or the continuation region opens up and becomes a cone in three-dimensional space. And this is classical homothetic property. So what you do in these kind of problems is to get rid of one dimension. Okay, if you have two stocks, you're living in three dimension, but since the no transaction region is a cone, it's provably a cone, you can get rid of one dimension by simply doing a change of variables, and you can start talking about fraction of wealth invested in one stock rather than the amount of wealth invested in a stock. So Si is the amount of wealth invested in the stock, and W is the sum of your entire wealth. So Xi becomes your state variable, and you can convert an n stock problem into an n-dimensional problem rather than n plus one-dimensional problem. So once you are in n dimensions, for example, in two dimensions in this particular figure, if you have two stocks, you can convert it into a two-state problem where each of the states represents the fraction of wealth in each stock. So if you're in two, if you have two assets and you plot these fractions of wealth invested in each of the assets in each of the axes, the optimal policy is going to look like a cut of this cone, which I've drawn here, and you expect to have four boundaries. Two for stock one and two for stock two. And the optimal policy, corresponding optimal policy, is to make no transactions if you find yourself dead. And if you start drifting off towards the edge of any boundary and try to cross the boundary, then you just make enough transactions. Just make enough transactions. That's critical in singular control to push the process back into your node transaction region. Okay? And that's the optimal policy. And obviously, the question right now is, how do you compute these boundaries? Okay, so we can use a change of variable. We can change the variables, as I talked about, and use dynamic programming arguments to obtain the corresponding Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation. And it turns out that you can always, in this particular kind of a case, you can switch the problem into a long-term growth rate maximization problem to a long-term cost minimization problem, which is just a little more convenient. And since it's average cost kind of a setup, so we're going to have to find V of X, the differential cost function, and D, the long-term asymptotic growth rate, asymptotic cost growth rate, that's right, such that instead of two terms like in the earlier American option pricing problem, we're going to have 2n plus 1 terms because corresponding to the different regions. We're going to have a no transactions region. We're going to have a region in which it's optimal to buy stock 1 all the way to a region where it's optimal to buy stock n, a region to that's supposed to be S1, sell stock 1 all the way to sell stock n. So you're going to have 2n plus 1 regions, and in the two-dimensional case, this corresponds to 5 regions. One no transaction region, two sell regions, and two buy regions. Okay, so we have this HJB equation here. All I want to point out here is that this term is a second order PDE, while each of these terms are first order. Okay, and the state space is partitioned to 2n plus 1 regions. And in terms of two dimensions, it's easy to visualize. So we're looking to find the differential cost function V and a constant D. The D is the one that we're trying to actually minimize in this case. We're looking for a value function V and a differential cost function V and a constant D such that LFV is equal to 0 in this region. Remember, LFV actually has D in it. LFV is equal to 0 in this region. B1 of V is equal to 0. B2 of V equal to 0 in these two corresponding buy regions. And cell 1 and cell 2 regions have S1 of V equals 0 and S2 of V equals 0. And of course, like in the previous case, we can draw four arbitrary boundaries. We can just draw four arbitrary boundaries and solve LFV equals 0 within and solve for these four equations outside, and we can piece together a value function. But of course, that value function will not satisfy this HJB equation, so it won't turn out to be the optimal value function. So again, like in the previous case, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to start with a guess omega naught. Okay, just arbitrarily draw four boundaries, and this is my guess value. The only assumption I make on this is that the optimal region of inaction, omega star, is a subset of my initial omega naught. Okay, so I start with such a guess, and once I have a guess, I can solve for the value associated with using this particular policy. Those are not the optimal policy. I can talk about this as a policy and talk about the value associated with this. So to obtain the value associated with this, I can solve LFV naught is equal to 0 within with the necessary boundary conditions in these four boundaries, and I can actually get the value associated with this boundary. Okay, so obviously this is going to be violated, right? Because if it is not violated, if it holds in the entire state space, then we actually have the optimal boundary. So this was going to be violated, and it turns out the violation, because of my assumption of omega star being a superset again, is going to be just in this gray area. Okay? And any region, exactly the same reasoning as before, any region in this gray area, any new region in this gray area is going to guarantee that I'm having an improved policy. But it doesn't guarantee that the new omega 1 that I obtain is going to be further a subset, is further going to be a superset of my unknown optimal region omega star. So it turns out that instead, if I define my new boundaries as a contour, if all my buy boundaries as a contour of this minimization term, and the contour of this minimization term is my definition for all the cell boundaries, it turns out that not only can I guarantee policy improvement, but I can guarantee that the optimal unknown region is further a subset of my omega 1. And these two terms are nothing more, this term is nothing more than the minimization of b1 of v0, and this is nothing more than the minimization of si of v0. Okay, so that's essentially what we are doing. We're looking for the region of violation, and we're choosing the contour of maximum violation, in some sense, smoothly trying to paste these together. Okay, another result, two-dimensional case, we have a correlated set of stocks. We have two stocks with the correlation matrix, the risk-free rate. We have a drift of 15% each, and we have transaction cost of 1% for each of each transaction. And we start with our initial guess, which is extremely close to zero here. But we start with that, and this is our first. I use a finite element-based solution mechanism, so I can get a very smooth interpolated value function. So we. That's how it converges. Obviously, since we have a correlated structure, we don't have rectangles anymore. We have polygons, regions that closely look like polygons, but they are actually not. Here, we do allow for non-polygonal entries, because if you see the first ones, they are actually curves. But further and further, it becomes closer to a polygon. OK, anyway, so now we have a two-dimensional example, right? The thing about two-dimensional example or any dimensional example is that for each, we convert the sequence of free boundary problems into a sequence, we convert the free boundary problem into a sequence of fixed boundary problems. But of course, even solving fixed boundary problems in something like five dimensions is going to be very hard, just because of discretization. So in the hope of solving portfolios of large dimensions, I'm talking about 10 dimensions, we essentially need to figure out how to get away from solving a 10-dimensional, even a fixed boundary problem. Because just discretizing 10-dimensional spaces just hard. So let's look at an experiment. So we consider a sequence of portfolios, portfolio optimization problems, where we increase n. So the first problem we talk about is just has one stock on one bank account. The second problem we're going to talk about has two stocks in one bank account, and so on and so forth, all the way, and see how the method or the computation times scale up. So we have a sequence of portfolios with increasing number of stocks. We have all alpha is set to 14%, this independent stocks, no correlation, transaction cost of 5%, and a risk-free rate of 10%. We have a finite element-based implementation on MATLAB, and as the number of stocks grow, this is on a very standard laptop computer, runtimes grow. I'm not worried about the magnitude, I'm worried about how they scale. Okay, so irrespective of going to a fast computer or not, it's going to scale badly. So we start with 34 seconds, two-dimensional 20 minutes, and three-dimensional 45 hours, at which point when I wrote the paper, I was hoping to run it over a week and actually get a number for four dimensions, but after a week or 10 days, it just didn't, so, stuck. So this is not going to help us, because solving even a fixed boundary problem in multiple dimensions is hard. So when a sequence of fixed boundary problems is going to obviously be hard, so let's revisit the scheme. So what are we doing here? We start with a guess boundary. We solve a PDE to obtain the value function, and we update the boundary. If you look closely, almost all the time we spend is in this step. The amount of time we spend in this step is probably less than 0.1%. When you get a large dimension, it's actually very quick. So most of the time you spend is in this step, and of course, because you're discretizing n-dimensional space, and you want to have a huge matrix that you'll have to invert and so on. So what can we do? Instead of solving a PDE, what else could we do? We have a policy. And all the PDE does is find the associated value function for that policy. So instead of solving the PDE, why not try and use simulation to actually get an estimate for that policy? Okay, so we have a guess boundary. Instead of actually solving for the entire value function, why not use simulation to get estimates of the value function at certain points in the space? Okay, so issues. We're going to have estimation errors, because obviously simulation errors, depending upon the amount of sample parts you use, are going to come in, and monotonicity is going to break, obviously, because earlier we argued that we're going to have a monotone sequence of regions, and now because of simulation errors, we can't guarantee this monotone sequence, so we'll have to allow for backing out, too, because we could have had a bad set of sample parts that have actually overestimated our boundaries. But the discretization is still a problem. Even the simplest discretization of p points on each axis is going to give you p to the power n points. So if I take the entire space and I start discretizing it up and start using simulation for each point, I'm going to have the same problem again. I'm not going to be able to walk away from the curse of dimensionality because the number of points grows up exponentially with dimension, and I'm still going to have an exponentially growing scaling with respect to dimension. So what we can do is, well, some of the fixes. So for estimation errors, in each of the iterations, we can increase the number of sample paths. So we get arbitrarily closer and closer. So we modify the procedure to allow for a backing out. Every time we move our procedure in, we increase our sample paths and check with the new resolution of sample paths whether we might have overstepped. If you have overstepped, go back to the previous boundary. Okay, so we are increasing sample paths during every iteration, and every time, because of your increase in sample paths, your increase in resolution, you always check for what we call a superset condition. We have a condition that you could check to see if you might have overstepped. If you overstepped, back up and proceed again with a higher sequence, a higher set of sample paths. And finally, discretization. Okay, here we have to go with an approximation. So what we do is, instead of allowing for any kind of free boundaries in high dimensional space, we make restrictions. In this particular case, we saw that without restrictions, the optimal region of inaction looked like it was being bounded by surfaces that looked pretty close to straight lines in two dimensions. So we're going to restrict our search for surfaces to hyperplanes. Okay? And if you restrict your search for surfaces to hyperplanes, you can actually become very clever in the way you discretize space. Instead of discretizing the entire space and finding out value functions, estimates for every point, what you can do is you can look at the direction in which you would like to move and discretize the points in that direction, and only one line in that direction, find estimates of the value function and gradient along all points of that direction, and then move your surface on that direction. Okay, and so you don't have to entirely discretize the entire state space. And by doing this, you can actually come down, for hyperpolygons particularly, you can actually come down to p times n cube points every iteration. So every iteration, we have p times n cube. P is the number of points you discretize any line with, and n is the number of dimensions. You can choose p to the n cube points in your space, discretize those points, use simulation to estimate value functions along those points, and now you can calculate your new boundaries using those. So it turns out, by just doing that, simulation versus number of the number of stocks, PD based and simulation based, of course, you know, for lower dimensional stocks, simulation is going to perform much worse because solving ODEs are very easy to do, but the scaling is much better. The better visualization of scaling is dimension in log scale, runtimes in log scale as well. And this is the PDE method, 0.1, 0.2, and 0.3 for three dimensions. And after that, we don't have data. And we have the simulation-based methods and a trend line that tracks that. So on a log-log scale, a linear line obviously corresponds to polynomial scaling. And so what we have here is close to cubic scaling. And again, this was run on a very simple computer, and simple calculations with extrapolations here and faster implementations. Of course, you know, this was again in MATLAB. You could get much faster implementations by using a compiled language. So doing something like a 10-dimensional example is not difficult. Okay, so I'll quickly talk about this cache management problem, which is an impulse control problem. Okay, so what we have already talked about is optimal stopping, which just had one boundary. We talked about singular control. Now this is an impulse control problem. Impulse control problems have a proportional transaction cost as well as a fixed transaction cost. Okay, because of a fixed transaction cost, it's optimal not to make infinitesimal changes to the state. But when you decide to apply control, it's obviously optimal to actually make a substantial control. So we take the classical cache management problem that was in Constantinides and Richard's paper, but this has a lot of applications too. So we have a firm with stochastic cache flows, and at any particular point in time, T, YT is the value of the cash with the firm, and HFYT is the holding cost or the cost of being at any state. So if YT is negative, then there are penalty costs, and if the YT is positive, holding too much cash is obviously lost opportunity, so you have opportunity costs. So if you do not have transactions, the optimal thing to do is to almost hold zero cash. And whenever cash is required, you just create the cash by making transactions, and that would cost you almost zero towards infinity. So the cash levels, but unfortunately in this kind of a setup, we have transaction costs, and cash can be controlled by buying or selling short-term securities, and the transaction costs have fixed component and possibly a proportional component as well. So there are several applications here, and the cash management is just a canonical setup in which the formulation is explained. You have index tracking, you have inventory management, the classical